Well, thank you very much, Max, and for that kind introduction. And could I say that we at the LSE are very enthusiastic about this partnership with UCT. We have a clear international strategy at the school, which is that we want to have a small number of institutional partnerships where we think that working together we can do things that we cannot do working separately. And we have at the moment 5 institutional partnerships, and my expectation is that it will top out at 6 or 7. So this is not that, you know, we have a partnership in every country. We have Columbia in the US, Sciences Po in Paris, Peking University, National University of Singapore, and now UCT. And we're strongly committed to developing research links, student exchanges, and indeed events like this. So we really hope that you will hear more about the LSE on this campus in the future. And it's a particular pleasure for me to be back here in Cape Town, where I haven't been for a decade or so, but because just near here, in the Parliamentary Club, not very far away, was the scene of my greatest ever sporting triumph. In fact, strictly speaking, I should say my only sporting triumph, when I won the Progressive Federal Party doubles tennis tournament. Now, you may say that your Vice Chancellor missed out in his reading of my CV the period during which I was a PFP Member of Parliament, and I never was, but I happened to be staying with one when they had this tournament. And along with Alex Bahrain, some of you will remember, we beat Fansale Slabbert and Tian van der Merwe in the final, which was a surprising result, particularly since I'm a pretty lousy tennis player, but Alex Bahrain's a very, very canny tennis player. So I was absolutely thrilled, and it's great to come back and relive the times when I could wield a tennis racket. Now I have to say that all I do in the sporting arena is that I do still play cricket regularly. I am an occasional off-spin bowler. I play regularly, but am rarely called on to bowl. And so it occurred to me that actually I would be much better off if I lived in South Africa, because if so, as an off-spinner who can actually slightly spin the ball, I'd almost certainly get a game in your national side. Indeed, I have another qualification, which is when things come to the crunch, I tend to choke. So I'd fit in ideally. Now, I am aware, when I talk about the financial crisis in South Africa, that it's not quite as big a deal in this country as it is in the UK. In the UK, we are still right in the middle of it, not in the sense that we still have banks collapsing every other week, but we are coping now with the consequences in terms of a huge fiscal deficit. That fiscal deficit not, I should say, primarily caused by the government having specifically to rescue the banks, but caused by the fact that we had a huge drop in output and that the government's revenues fell very sharply, because a very large proportion of those revenues came from profits in the financial sector. And that's really the reason why we have such a big budget hole. So in the UK, where we are engaged in public expenditure cuts and layoffs in the public sector, the financial crisis and why it happened is a much liver and sharper edged debate than it is here. But nonetheless, there are, of course, some interesting dimensions for South Africa. I met your finance minister yesterday for an hour or so. I asked him for a loan, actually, because we're rather short of cash just now. And he was very clear, of course, that South Africa was affected by the slowdown and, of course, is looking hard at how to restructure its financial regulation system in the light of the lessons learned in the crisis. The government has published a paper explaining how it plans to change and how it plans to alter the role of the Reserve Bank. So, in fact, these issues are quite current in the policy debate in Pretoria. And also, of course, South Africa is now closely involved because you are now in the key decision-making bodies that oversee the world's financial system in the way that you were not before the crisis. So since the G7 gave way to the G20, South Africa is a member of all of the exotic range of committees, Basel Committee, etc., who make all these rules. So soon, you will be responsible, and indeed, when the next crisis comes, it'll be your fault. Almost certainly. I hope that's a comforting observation for you as we start. Now, why bother, in the light of all that, ask about the financial crisis and who caused it? Well, I think there are three particular reasons. The first is because there is a serious risk, I think, in drawing the wrong lessons from events. I mean, people say it's important not to waste a good crisis, and I think the financial crisis is a crucial one from which to learn the right lessons. And this failure has many parents, some of whom are illegitimate, I think. There are French obsessions with offshore centres, German obsessions with hedge funds. Some of these things, I think, had very little to do with the crisis. And as a result, there's a serious risk of displacement activity, of curing problems that didn't really exist, and indeed, sometimes of drawing false comfort from things that we think we've solved, but which were not really at the heart of the crisis. But also, I think we do have to recognise that the economic and social costs have been enormous, that global unemployment has been estimated by the ILO to be 15 million higher than before the crisis. So I do think we can't just ignore this, regard it as a hiccup, a series of technical problems we can forget about. We really do have to think about who was to blame for it. Now, it's convenient, of course, to say, well, we know who it is. It's George Bush and Gordon Brown. I see one, two blank faces. He used to be our prime minister. I know he's... I know people have short memories. But when you ask people who they think is responsible, what do they say? Well, curiously, I haven't been able to find, perhaps because you didn't have anything like a crisis we had, any specifically South African responses to this. But curiously, there are surveys in Nigeria and Kenya and Egypt among African countries, and it's interesting to compare the responses with the UK, where in the UK it's quite clear that people think that's a third bar down, fourth bar down, that it's basically international bankers taking excessive risks, or indeed even more so our own bankers, and indeed it was consumers taking on far more debt. We tend not to think particularly it was economic policies of China. We quite think it's the economic policies of the US. In fact, British respondents to this have a reasonably balanced view about what it was. They accept that in addition to the bankers, you know, there has to be two sides to every transaction, and that individuals taking on more debt than they can afford was quite important. Actually, if you look at these surveys, and I've looked at them around the world, it is quite amusing. If you ask the French, they say it's Anglo-Saxon bankers. If you asked Gordon Brown, he said it was the Americans. If you asked the Indians, they think it was the economic policies of China. And so it goes on. If you're in New Zealand, where I was recently, they think it was the Australians. Everybody has their own hate figures. I'm not quite sure who it is for South Africa. Maybe it's Lesotho or somewhere obscure, but I don't know. But there are some less savoury views about this. A fairly recent survey said that 32% of Democrats in the United States think it was the Jews, which is a slightly depressing conclusion, you might think. So it is quite important, I think, to try to get a clear view about how all this happened, because you don't want to have develop a set of potentially dangerous myths about what went wrong. And it was really in that spirit that I produced this book last year, which was a kind of exercise for myself, which was partly conceived as a sort of teaching aid, really. And I decided to do a kind of inventory of all the different explanations for the crisis. And in fact, I identified an extensive survey of the literature, 38 separate explanations for the crisis, which are seriously advanced. Now, don't worry. I'm only going to spend about 5 minutes on each of them. You'll be okay for the last bus home. Now, I did also at the end, however, and this is for the people who plan to doze off for the next half hour, I'll give you the answer straight away. This was my 39th conclusion. And this essentially is the sort of guide to what I plan to say, that it began with very loose macroeconomic conditions, global imbalances, loose monetary policy, creating conditions in which money was cheap and credit was very, very easily available. There was then a trigger in the form of the subprime crisis when suddenly people lost confidence in a particular type of instrument. That was serious because the watchdogs had been dozing, by which I mean the banking system had been allowed to expand its leverage with too little capital. There were a whole bunch of people who were supposed to be helpful in this crisis, like auditors and rating agencies, etc., who were either completely useless or complicit. There were also some bankers who either were crooked, but perhaps more specifically were simply out for the main chance and didn't particularly care about the products they were selling and who was buying them and why. That underlying all of this was a faulty view about the way markets operated, which is what I mean by irrational expectations. And then there are a few slightly wildcard explanations, which I find a little bit difficult to integrate into one story, but which are, I think, quite thought-provoking about how we might think about responding to bubbles in the future. So all of that produced a combustible mixture. And that's essentially the map I'm going to try to take you round, starting in the northwest corner. I guess if we're in the southern hemisphere, do we have to say, is that the southeast corner? I don't know. I mean, whichever way it is. First of all, then, macroeconomic conditions. And I think Ben Bernanke, in a sense, has this right. It's impossible to understand the crisis without reference to the global imbalances in trade and capital flows, which began in the latter half of the 1990s. And one just vivid representation of that. This shows the current account balances, surpluses above the line, deficits below the line, as a percentage of world GDP during the early part of the last decade. Sorry, the headline there, it's not 93 to 2009, 2001 to 2009. And the bottom bar is the US, the big sort of green bar is the US, and you could see that what happened was a very rapid explosion of surpluses for the China, particularly, and the oil exporting countries, with corresponding very large deficits on the part of the US in particular and some other European countries. What did this do? Well, it created a flood of money looking for a home in the US, particularly, a flood of dollars earned by the Chinese and the oil exporters. And they were looking for a home, and at that time, if you recall, interest rates were then very low. You earned very, very little on US treasuries. People didn't want particularly risky assets because these were surpluses that they were retaining in sovereign wealth funds, etc., and they were looking for safe assets. But there were not enough safe assets available, so assets that looked safe were created. And this was, if you like, the demand-side explanation for the curious subprime, if you remember, super senior subprime assets that were generated by the financial institutions to look as if these were safe assets, but which were yielding a bit more than US treasuries, which were yielding almost nothing. So this was the first dimension of it, a large amount of money, very loose liquidity conditions, a large amount of money looking for a home. So how did the central banks react? Well, John Taylor, who's the creator of the famous Taylor Rule, which best describes the way central banks think about monetary policy, is that he argues there was clear evidence of monetary excesses during the period leading up to the housing boom. Alan Greenspan argues that it was really long-term interest rates that galvanized home asset prices, not the overnight rates of central banks. But I think most people would now say, well, there is nonetheless some relationship between short and long rates, and that loose monetary policy was undoubtedly a contributory factor. And if you look at That, and particularly you look here at the little red line, this is the deviation of policy rates from the Taylor rule. The Taylor rule looks at inflation and expectations of inflation and says what is the kind of neutral monetary policy that a central bank adopts. And the US adopted a very loose monetary policy. Now, the original reason for this was when the dot-com boom of 2000-2001 combined with 9/11, which made the Americans, particularly the Fed, absolutely terrified at the prospect that the US would be kicked into recession, that that could have very unpleasant political consequences as well, which is a reasonable fear. They pushed interest rates down to very low levels in order to respond to that fear. But they kept them there for too long, in my view. So this was initially a good response, but which was held for too long. Behind this, you could see a focus on narrow interpretations of the central bank mandate. In other words, the Fed and the Bank of England and the ECB were focusing on retail price inflation. And retail price inflation seemed to be just fine. So during this period, there seemed to be no strong argument for raising interest rates because inflation was low. In retrospect, I think we can see that one reason why inflation was low was because of this wave of highly competitive exports coming out of China on a huge scale for the first time, which was holding down inflationary pressures so that companies were not able to raise prices faced with this very cheap competition, but which was creating these very loose credit conditions at the same time. So the image I like to suggest is that the central banks were a bit like a driver who is driving prudently at the speed limit, checking that the speed limit is absolutely fine, 30 miles an hour, not a bit below, not a bit above. But in the meantime, the engine is overheating and the wheels are falling off. And it looks as if you're just doing fine. But in fact, we were seeing a large expansion in asset prices and a boom in credit and leverage, which was not being picked up by the retail price inflation numbers. So a huge bubble was created. What should be done about that? Well, Greenspan is unrepentant. He says, I think preventing bubbles will turn out to be infeasible, and mopping up after their aftermath seems the best we can hope for. And that was his essential justification for not responding to the signs that there were about the inflation of the bubble. But other people say, no, surely we must be able to do better than that. We should be able to lean against the wind. And there's a whole economic literature now under the heading of leaning against the wind, that at least if you see one of these bubbles expanding, surely you should attempt to push against it with monetary policy. And a third school of thought, which says, well, you may not be able to do it with monetary policy, but surely you should have an ability to change the regulatory system and to tighten the rules on banks when you see credit expanding very quickly in order to offset the risks of this turning into a boom and bust. I have to say that personally, I favour some combination of two and three. I think you have to think about credit conditions when you think about monetary policy, but I also agree that you do need another tool to respond. But let's get back then, after that brief interlude into this bubbles debate, into what actually happened in the crisis. I mean, are we comfortable with this explanation that it was a large credit bubble, a large increase in leverage? Now, and then the question then, if you are comfortable with that, and I think there's a lot of evidence for it, why did it happen? Why was there this demand for borrowing on the part of individuals? And not because, in order for a huge amount of credit to be created, you do need to have a combination of a lender and a borrower. And one interesting theory, which I think does have quite a lot to commend it, is that, advanced by Joe Stiglitz in a UN report, that the negative impact of stagnant real incomes, and if you look at what happened in the US particularly, and to some extent in Europe, that average incomes were going nowhere during this period. that incomes on the whole were rising, but mainly for people at the top end of the income distribution. And the income inequality measures, the Gini coefficient, the usual one people use, was growing in this period, particularly in the United States. So ordinary US families found their income stagnating, but they did find that there were banks who were delighted to lend them more money. Delighted to lend them money for house purchase in particular, even if they had very poor credit histories, if they had no job, the famous no income, no job loans, the ninja loans. And as a result, they financed an increasing standard of living through borrowing. And the lax monetary policy with low interest rates enabled that to happen. And the banks made it easier by a combination of expanding their own balance sheets and by creating these fancy new instruments, these securitizations, which facilitated credit creation even further outside the banking system. And this was not just a US phenomenon. In the UK, we had our borrowing rise to higher levels than in the US as a percentage of GDP. And the UK had a boost to economic growth on average during this period for 5 or 6 years. Our economic growth was 1% higher than Germany, and it was primarily financed by an increase in borrowing, an increase in consumption, which reflected itself in a balance of payments deficit, as we have seen. So we were the same as the Americans in one respect, not quite with the same kinds of instruments, not quite the same focus on the housing market. The banks were delighted to meet this appetite, and bank balance sheets expanded dramatically. This just shows you the relationship between banks' assets in the US and their total capital, in other words, their reserves. And it rose from, you know, 20-something times in as recently as 2003 to 43 times in 2007. The really striking, dramatic expansion of the leverage within the banking system in a very short period of time. And the same is true in the UK, where it began in 2003. I particularly like this chart because I stopped being the UK's banking regulator in 2003. Now, we therefore saw a huge expansion of leverage in the US banking system and in the UK banking system. And on top of this, I say we saw credit created outside the banking system through securitization of loans, which were pushed off banks' balance sheets, so giving them the ability to create even more credit, and those securitized loans held by all kinds of investors around the world. And that created the trigger. These off-balance sheet subprime securitized loans, which were essentially very poor credits that the banks had dumped off their balance sheets, and those securitizations depended on continued rises in house prices. Because as soon as house prices started to fall, then the borrowers couldn't keep on reborrowing, which is what they kept doing. They were remortgaging. The average life of these loans was only 3 years. People borrowed to get into the house, then they ran into trouble for repayments because they didn't have a job, so they'd then reborrow. The house price had gone up, not a problem. Borrow another $15,000, which allows you to pay the interest for a while. And this kind of mechanism only needed house prices to stop rising for it to come crashing down. And that's why this trigger point was the subprime debt. Now, why is it that this was allowed to happen? Do we not have regulators who are supposed to prevent this? Because it's one thing to have this surplus of wave of money coming through the global imbalances, a loose monetary policy that accommodates them, the desire on the part of people to try to maintain their real incomes by borrowing because their incomes were not rising, partly because, of course, of competition from super competitive nations. Why was it that the regulatory system didn't put a constraint on this activity? Well, there was too little capital in the banking system. This was something we can say now with hindsight. I didn't think so at the time, and nor did any of the other banking regulators. These were global rules that everybody at the time was happy with. But we can now see that banks were allowed to operate with too little capital, and that the leverage grew, and when the losses started to emerge because of this change in the profile of house prices, the banks didn't have enough reserves to cope with those losses. And therefore, some of them fell into the arms of the government, whether in the US, in the UK, in Belgium, in Germany, or in many other places. And this was a serious problem. So the main lesson that regulators have learned is that in future banks will need much more capital. And Basel III, which is the revised regulatory approach to banks, will increase the amount of reserves that banks have to have, both in their banking books but also in their trading books where they hold these securitizations, and some of them did, and also outlaw soft capital and some other technical stuff I won't go into. The big issue, of course, is how far you should go in this, because the safer you make banks, that's absolutely fine, but of course, if you make them totally safe, then you remove some of their economic utility. I mean, I have an easy idea about how to make banks completely safe, is that they should keep 100 cents of every rand you deposit with them in a box. And that would be fine. You'd always be able to get it back. They wouldn't lend it to anybody and no economic activity would be generated, but it would be safe. So as soon as you allow any kind of on-lending of deposits, risk enters the system. The question is how much risk you want to allow. At the moment, I think the new rules are reasonable, but there are a lot of people arguing that they should be even tighter. The second problem about the rules that were governing the banking system was that it was not just that there was too little capital, but that the capital did not respond to changing economic conditions. Indeed, the capital rules tended to accentuate the economic cycle. And the reason for that is that if you are a regulator and you go into a bank and you try to work out how much capital it should hold in reserve, and of course you have to do that calculation for each individual bank, because banks, some of them are relatively low risk, lending to the government and taking deposits and buying government bonds. That's a low risk activity. You shouldn't have to have a lot of reserves for that. Others are taking deposits and investing in speculative property ventures, and therefore they should hold larger reserves. So you have to do this calculation for each one. But what you typically do is you go in and say, show me your book of loans. Show me how that loan book would have behaved over the last, say, 10 years. At what point in the last 10 years, if you held those loans you have today, would you have lost the most money? And that's your benchmark for how much capital you should. Because that would say, well, if you'd held this loan book for the last 10 years, you'd have stayed in business all the time. That's what you're trying to do as a regulator. But, of course, if you go through a long, long cycle where property prices rise and rise and rise, and you look at people's property lending now, and you track it back for 10 years, they'd never have lost any money. So just at the point where the property market peaks, the model tells you don't need any capital at all. So surely you have to have some method of taking account of the fact that you may be in a cyclical boom, and you might need to look at the ratio of asset prices to their long-run value, etc., and see whether that tells you that actually you should be increasing the reserves because the risk of a downturn has gone up. So essentially, that's the argument for this famous macroprudential stuff, which you read quite a bit about. So I think this was the core of the regulatory problem, or, if you like, the dozing watchdogs bit of my chart. So now, just to remind you, we've got round to the dozing watchdogs, and I don't think you can blame the regulators for everything, but I think in retrospect you can see that there was too little capital in the system. Then what about these complicit controllers? Well, I think some of this is not very serious. I mean, there's a lot of fuss about fair value accounting, which may have accentuated losses to a certain extent, but nonetheless, these losses turned out to be real, so I don't regard this as particularly serious. But I do think, and this is something I think has not attracted as much public attention, you do have to ask yourself a question about the auditors. I hope there aren't any auditors in the room because I'm going to be rude about them now, but I think that they're essentially in the chocolate teapot category of uselessness during this crisis. I mean, the auditors signed off on Lehman Brothers as a going concern about 2 weeks before it completely collapsed. Now, maybe it isn't their job to forecast the future, but if that's the case, what is the point exactly? And I do think we have to ask some questions about what the value of this rather formulaic approach we now have to auditing. And certainly, the audited accounts of banks that went bust told you nothing about their riskiness or their likelihood of going bust, even a short time before they did. Also, of course, the rating agencies did not cover themselves in glory in this crisis either. By the end of 2007, there were 12 corporates in the United States, 12 companies in the United States, which had AAA status. I mean, companies like GE and Procter & Gamble, etc. And there were 65,000 asset-backed securitizations that had AAA status. And the rating agencies applied the same scale to these complicated securitizations whose behavior in a crisis or in a constrained liquidity environment they could not forecast. They pretended that they were as safe as corporate bonds from companies that had been in business profitably for 100 years. And this can't be sensible, I think. So these controllers, I think, the private sector controllers, if you like, were not very helpful. But what about the firms themselves? Well, they, of course, have come in for their fair share of criticism, most notoriously in the famous Rolling Stone article about Goldman Sachs, which described them as a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity, relentlessly jabbing its blood funnel into anything that smells like money. I tried to see if this looked at all like Tito and Bueni, but I'm not sure that it does, really. But Goldman Sachs became the kind of poster child of the problems in the financial crisis. My own view is that the notion that there was a lot of genuine fraud in this crisis is one which I find there is little support for. And indeed, I mean, I think that, you know, the federal prosecutors in the US and the FSA, if they could have found some people to lock up, they would have done so because they had every corporate interest. And I don't think, I think it was kind of worse than fraud. You know, in other words, I think these people actually believed it, what they were doing, in the sense that I don't think these firms were cynical conspiracies. Now, maybe I'm naive, but I don't think that they were cynical conspiracies, but I do think that they believed that they had created the philosopher's stone, that they had created money machines which would carry on turning. So I think that they are guilty more, in my mind, of naivete than of actual fraudulent behavior. But the key issue, really, which, from a public policy point of view, is whether there were incentive structures in these firms which we collectively as a society connived in, which drove them to more and more risky behavior, knowing that if things went wrong, someone else would pick up the bill. I mean, this is the sort of moral hazard argument. Were these bankers on a process where, you know, they could take more and more risk, knowing that that would generate more and more return and higher bonuses, and if it all went wrong, well, the taxpayer would pick up the tab. And this is essentially the interesting part of this story. And this is something where there are very many different views. I mean, Tim Geithner, the US Treasury Secretary, argues that compensation and incentives to create, to take risk, did contribute to the vulnerability we saw in the crisis. Adair Turner, who in other respects, now my successor at the FSA, has been very, very critical of the banking sector, is not convinced that remuneration structures were as important as inadequate approaches to capital. I'm always intrigued, by the way, as someone who kind of goes backwards and forwards across the Atlantic, that in the UK we call pay remuneration, typically, whereas in the US they use this really peculiar, mealy-mouthed term, compensation. You know, as if you are somehow compensating people for the terrible trouble it is to come into the office, you know, and to do all these wonderful transactions. I mean, it's an interesting mindset revealed, I think, by that use of that word. There's academic research is rather ambiguous on this subject, I have to say. Indeed, there's people who say that there's no evidence that banks with it, whose incentives were better aligned with the interests of their shareholders, in other words, who were paid in a long-term way rather than on short-term profits, did perform actually better. But there are others in Harvard who say that, in fact, bankers do have too little incentive to give to look at the downside of strategies, that they get paid sort of in equities, which tend to focus on future profitability, and when things go wrong, it's actually the bondholders who typically lose out. So they argue that people should be paid in bonds. What do I think about this? Well, my own view is that the argument, as I say, that these were kind of conspiracies led by people at the top who cynically took the view that they could make out like bandits and the taxpayer would bail them out, I don't find terribly persuasive. I mean, even Dick Fuld, not a somewhat charmless individual you might think, who ran Lehman Brothers, I don't think he wanted to spend the rest of his life in a position where he can't go out of his house. I don't think that people thought that way. On the other hand, I do think that they devised incentive structures within their firms where the individual traders were in fact compensated on profits that turned out subsequently to be illusory. So I think they were guilty of creating risk structures within firms that rewarded people on the basis of short-term profits, or looked to be profits, because you mark these instruments to market at the end of a year and you say, boy, we've made some money out of this, but where a subsequent crash could cause you to lose more than you'd ever gained. And yet you'd paid a lot of it out in bonuses. And that seems to me to be the fundamental flaw. Not that this was a kind of top-down conspiracy, but that these people had devised systems to create incentives for their traders to take more risks. But behind these crooks and spiffs lurk an even more sinister group. I hardly dare utter the word. Economists. What about them? And as the analysis of the crisis has developed, economists have started to come in for their share of the blame. And essentially, there are two sets of arguments here. One is that the economists' rational expectations model was a very poor way of thinking about how economic agents behave. Paul Krugman puts it rather bluntly, but he always writes entertainingly, that economists as a group mistook beauty clad in impressive-looking mathematics for truth. They turned a blind eye to the limitations of human rationality that often led to bubbles and busts. And Willem Bouter from the LSE referred to the unfortunate uselessness of most state-of-the-art academic monetary economics as having no explanatory power in relation to this crisis. However, you know, the Chicago people, this is often in the economics translated into a debate between saltwater and freshwater economists. You know, the saltwater economists on the East Coast, the Krugmans at Princeton and the Bouters at the LSE, versus the freshwater ones, who are the people in the real sort of temple of efficient markets at Chicago. And Anna Schwartz, who's the famous Milton Friedman's co-author, make great textbook on monetary economics, said, look, you know, this is just a business cycle. You know, this has been happening for centuries. Why should we think that this invalidates our views about the way the world ought to be? And Lucas, the great grandfather of rational expectations, says, I see no connection between the reality of macroeconomics that these people represent and the caricature provided by the critics. However, I think that in one particular area, there is a serious case to answer, and that is in relation to the famous efficient markets hypothesis. And it is true, I think, that much teaching about markets begins from that point, even if people then go and say, well, of course, you know, there are circumstances in which efficient markets hypothesis doesn't perhaps fully hold, but it is still the kind of basis of the way in which we think about markets. Now, here again, there's a rather interesting argument. Eugene Farmer, who is one of the original gurus inventing the efficient markets hypothesis, says, you know, how can you blame the efficient markets hypothesis when all of this investing was done by investors who proclaim that they don't believe in it? Which is a kind of an interesting debating point, because clearly most active fund managers, otherwise they wouldn't exist if they thought they believed in efficient markets hypothesis. But I do think that the efficient markets hypothesis, with its foundation in rational expectations, created an intellectual climate within which it was difficult to question market prices. I mean, this was sort of famously expressed by Margaret Thatcher, you know, you can't buck the market. And I think it was true that central banks and regulators, and I speak here from personal experience, were generally in a mindset which was, well, if you looked at something that appeared to be balmy going on in the markets, you'd say, well, but it can't be, because there's a willing buyer and there's a willing seller here. And so this price, these prices, must be, in some sense, reflecting a balance of expectations, because otherwise, you know, why would people be trading at these prices? There was a kind of mindset that made it intellectually difficult for the authorities to challenge what was going on in markets. And I think that one positive consequence of the analysis post-crisis has been that regulators and central bankers now have somewhat more confidence to say, no, you know, we are not going to assume that these transactions and these prices and these instruments make sense. We're going to look at them very carefully and see whether we really do, whether you really understand what you're doing. And the notion that these firms do understand better than regulators, I think, has been exploded, and exploded for a long time to come. So I think that sort of psychological point strikes me as probably more important than some of the detailed arguments about which aspects of the efficient markets hypothesis might be wrong. And I think we need to go back to some of the old truths about financial markets, that, you know, if a thing is too good to be true, it probably isn't. That if a thing can't go on forever, it will probably end one day. These are the sort of wise old saws that you hear in the markets, and I think we have to go back to thinking that we must challenge apparently irrational transactions, because they might actually be so and not really be a reflection of a balance of traders with rational expectations. So more self-confident regulators is, I think, one necessary response to the crisis. So that's my prime hypothesis: the loose macro conditions, the trigger from the house price market, the inadequacies of the capital regime, which prevented, we didn't prevent this leverage from happening, a useless bunch of controllers, some firms who had generated perverse incentives for themselves and built on a faulty intellectual model about how markets operate. But there are, as I said, and I'm going to end quickly now, just one or two other wild cards that we might think about. Here's one wild card, the Archbishop of Canterbury, quite a wild card actually, but he argued that as religious leaders, he said, we want to say that the root of this is human greed. Well, of course, greed, a tricky word, because one person's greed is another person's earnest desire to do better for himself and his family. You know, this is another way of thinking about greed. So why, in these circumstances, did greed, which we might otherwise regard as, you know, part of the sort of animal spirits of innovation and wealth creation, suddenly turn into something rather dangerous? And there was an interesting Oxford Roundtable Forum on Public Policy which said that essentially what happened was that after a long period when markets could seem to do no wrong, a long period of expansion with prices going all in one direction, that the normal kind of risk-reward balance in traders' brains went out of kilter. You know, normally, you know, if you're picking apples from a tree and you can see the juicy one up there, you know there is a balance. I mean, it would be great to get it, but actually you might also fall off the ladder. And so something kind of causes you not to do it. But as markets continued, it seemed like you could do no wrong in these markets, people's assumptions about risk and reward became out of line, and the sort of greed appetite became dominant. And I think this is an interesting point to think about. I don't think it's a separate explanation, if you like. It's a kind of complementary explanation as to why the borrowers and lenders seem to have a continued appetite for transactions, which in retrospect look to have been pretty crazy. But here's another one. Is it a boy thing? There's an interesting Scientific American study which tested people's risk-seeking characteristics. So you gave people, it was a real life with real money investment game, and offered them different kinds of gambles. And it turned out when they tested the people that risk-taking was positively correlated with testosterone. that the stronger the testosterone in your saliva, the more likely you were to take imprudent risks. So at this point, all the women in the audience are smiling, saying, "We knew it. It was a boy thing. It's nothing to do with us." The only trouble is the presence of women on the trading floor ratchets up testosterone levels among the men. And also, during menstruation, women do not bid differently from men, which creates some interesting challenges for people managing trading floors. Excuse me, Fiona, is it okay to put you on the municipal bond desk today, or are we going to lose a lot of money? Which is rather tricky. So, girls, sorry, it's not necessarily purely a boy thing. There's another explanation came out of a professor of pharmacology at Oxford saying it's all to do with video games. That, in fact, people's that traders' main recreation when they're not trading is now playing Tomb Raider or whatever the latest thing is. That probably shows how out of date I am. And in fact, what happens is a species of alienation, because you get used to the idea that you deal on a screen with fanciful events and where you zap people, kill people, etc. And it's not real, you know, because it's not really happening, but that is what you spend your time doing. And then when you get to the trading floor, you know, it's the same. It's not real. It's just a game that you're playing, and if things go wrong, well, what the hell? You just go back down a level. And that there was a sense, and there's some interviews of people that they didn't really kind of register that this was reality. This was a game that they were playing, and that's because that's what they do mainly with their spare time. So I don't think you can prove this, but I found it quite a provocative and quite an interesting hypothesis. So where are we now at the end of all of this? Well, I think we are on the way to solving some of these problems. What I've divided here into, I mean, this is slightly heroic categorization, but I think there are some problems and there are some non-problems, and there are some problems that are solved and there are problems that are not really solved. So I think we have got a better regime for bank capital. I haven't really talked about derivatives transparency, but I think that has been improved significantly. We've got a better regime for liquidity. We've kind of partly solved the banker's incentive problem. It's actually being solved in different ways in different places, but you know, people are requiring bankers to be paid in deferred ways such that, you know, there's clawback mechanisms. So if these profits do turn out to be illusory, they don't get the money. I think there's quite a lot of progress that's been made in that area. The global imbalances story, well, I'm not quite sure that we can say that we have. You know, the Chinese exchange rate, the Chinese still don't want to talk about it, but it clearly is part of the story. It looks likely, with what's going on with oil prices at the moment, that we're going to get another bout of very loose financial conditions generated by another boom in the oil price. I don't think we've done a great deal about income inequality. If you think that is part of the story and part of the sort of demand side explanation, I can't see an awful lot of progress on that. The whole dimension issue about monetary policy and financial stability, well, I think it's on the way to being solved. We have a new framework in the UK. There's a new framework now in the European Union to bring financial stability considerations into monetary policy. And there is, to be frank, quite a bit of work going on this macroprudential countercyclical capital. We haven't got a set of rules yet that really work, but I think we may well have. The one that worries me perhaps the most in this area is that we're already seeing signs of countries choosing to devise regulatory systems to attract mobile financial business again, and a species of regulatory arbitrage taking place, so that people are trying to place their financial activity in less toughly regulated jurisdictions, which I think is quite a dangerous thing. So I think we're kind of halfway through a program of remedy of the financial crisis. Some of the things maybe we'll never know whether they were contributory factors. The arguments about greed and video games, etc., I just think are things that are worthy of more research, which is always, of course, a good way to end a presentation of an academic kind. It's where every good paper ends, with a demand for more research. Thank you.